This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. Coming up, author Peter Bergen will be here to talk about his latest book on Osama bin Laden. Bergen creates a portrait of the al-Qaeda leader by stitching together the oral and written accounts of those who knew him well. He'll also be taking your calls. But first, confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito are nearing an end. Today's the fourth day. The judge has finished taking testimony, taking questions from senators on the Judiciary Committee. Yesterday, tempers flared between Senator Edward Kennedy and Committee Chairman Arlen Specter over Judge Alito's inability to remember whether he was a member of a college group called Concerned Alumni of Princeton. That group was started by some Princeton alumni in the 70s to protest the admission of women to Princeton and the increased admission of minorities. Also yesterday, the judge's wife, Martha Ann Alito, left the hearing room in tears after an exchange by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who asked Judge Alito if he was, quote, a closet bigot. As the hearings wind down, we want to take your questions. Have you learned anything new about Samuel Alito, the man? You have questions about how the nomination process works. What exactly is a unitary executive, and what are presidential signing statements? These terms and many others have come up this week. We'll find out what they mean. You can call with your questions. Our number in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email address totn@npr.org. With us from his office in New York is Noah Feldman. He's a law professor at New York University. Professor Feldman, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have asked you to help us through this hearing and understand what's going on, but tell us so far what has been outstanding to you.
What's outstanding is just how little has been outstanding. Judge Alito is obviously a very intelligent person and a good lawyer, and he's been able to use those traits to essentially avoid giving any deeply substantive answers to any of the questions that have been put to him. And for their part, the senators haven't put questions to him that would have required a kind of detailed or sophisticated constitutional answer. So, truth to be told, I don't think the hearings have revealed anything very deep about where Judge Alito stands. But by the same token, I don't think the senators have put him in a place where he would have had to reveal that.
Well, tell me a little bit about the genesis of this process. Seems to me there was a time when the point was to see whether a candidate was qualified. The ideological test was clear. If the president wanted this person, they were in the president's camp. That had been taken for granted at one point, wasn't it? And that wasn't part of this process. It was simply qualifications and whether or not, you know, corruption was part of the...
Well, the history is a little more complicated than that. I think in the early years of the Republic, politics played an enormous role in people's thinking about who should make it onto the Supreme Court. But the actual idea that there would be a confirmation hearing at which the nominee himself or herself would appear and answer questions is actually a much more modern phenomenon. Well into the 20th century, the nominee didn't even appear in front of the Senate. Sometimes a nominee would just send a representative over to the legislature to answer questions. And at other times, nobody would appear at all, and the debate would take place in the candidate's absence. But in the sort of post-war era, it became increasingly common for nominees to show up. And I think with the hearings for Judge Robert Bork, we got the sort of highest point of debate where there was actually substantive, detailed debate about the nominee's actual constitutional views, which he, to his credit, very forthrightly put on the table.
And is that the role of the Senate in this process?
That's a question for serious controversy. All the Constitution says is that the president nominates the nominee, and the nominee is confirmed with the advice and consent of the Senate. So it's up to each senator to decide what he or she thinks the words advice and consent mean. And all we can go by is historical practice. And as I just suggested, the historical practice has changed a lot over time.
Why did it change? Why did candidates suddenly start showing up? Or maybe the other way, why did they not come, before, say, 50 years ago?
Probably it has a lot to do with the increased politicization of the nominations process. And as the question of who's going to be on the Supreme Court has increasingly been a question of national importance that ordinary people all over the country cared about, that's become more and more central. That, in turn, is connected to the rise of a judiciary that actually does a lot, a court that actually intervenes frequently in overturning either laws that Congress passed or laws that the states have passed. And that's really been going on for most of a century. And there were very controversial Supreme Court nominations even early in the century. When Justice Brandeis was nominated to the court, there was tremendous opposition, partly anti-Semitic opposition, but also partly opposition grounded in the idea that he was a friend of the laboring man and that he would stand for the interests of common people, and that was considered problematic by some of the business interests.
So far, what has been the most contentious issue or what the most contentious issues do you think for Judge Alito?
The most important issue, I would say, so far that's been discussed is that of executive power. How much power does the president have? And the reason that's been significant is not that it's in Judge Alito's written record, because as a judge on the Third Circuit in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, he didn't have too many cases that involved this question. The reason it's significant is that it's in the news as a central issue in our constitutional balance of powers, since we've got a president who's gone very far in terms of demanding greater executive power, and with the recent news of the eavesdropping on conversations of U.S. persons, apparently in violation of at least the text of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, we've got more discussions of presidential power. So it's been a big deal because it's in the news and because it's going to be coming before the Supreme Court in the near future.
I'm always curious about this kind of questioning where you try to get at the candidate's, the nominee's ideology. And it seems to me that when the case comes up, the one they're all sort of aiming at through their questioning, the particulars of that case can render all of the questioning and all of the answers given in this process moot, to use a legal term.
They can, but what you can sometimes get is some indication, admittedly vague, of what kind of framework a potential justice would use. And we've had that in the case of this executive power question. Judge Alito several times said that he would use a framework for consideration that's called the Youngstown framework. It's named for the Steele seizure case, in which the Supreme Court overturned President Truman's attempt to nationalize the steel mills during the Korea War. And he said that he would use a particular opinion, Justice Jackson's concurrence in that case, which evaluates how you should think about the question of presidential power vis-a-vis Congress. And in so saying, Judge Alito was signaling, perhaps subtly, but he was signaling, that he didn't have the view that the president could always do whatever he wanted, subject to a constitutional right to act in a certain area, but that Congress had some say in the process as well. So that was, I think, a significant thing for him to do, and I think it gave some indication, not a definitive one, but some indication of how he might at least think about those kinds of problems.
I'm talking with New York University Law Professor Noah Feldman today about the Alito hearings so far, and we're taking your phone calls. If you have an idea about how things have gone, what have you learned about Sam Alito, what would you like to know about the process, you can call us at 800-989-8255. Dave has done that from Overland Park, Kansas. Hello, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, good.
You've asked us what we've learned from the hearings. You know, I've watched a lot of it on TV, and honestly, I haven't learned much, except the animosity between the Republicans and the Democrats just keeps getting worse, especially since that outburst by Ted Kennedy. And honestly, I think it's going to hurt a lot of the people who want to run for these type of offices if they're going to have to go before Congress.
Thank you, Dave. Has that had a chilling effect? We've seen these wars. Certainly, you go back to the Bork case, but since then, certainly these have become not only for Supreme Court but other nominees as well. Do you think this has had a chilling effect on nominees, and are we getting the best candidates for these jobs because of the process they have to go through?
There is a tendency, I think, for people looking to make the nominations to look for people who haven't written extensively on highly controversial issues. In the case of Judge Alito, there were lots of judicial opinions, hundreds and hundreds of judicial opinions. But there was basically no paper record of articles, speeches, or arguments of that type. And to the extent there were any speeches, they did come up and they became controversial. So what we're essentially doing is we're moving in a direction where we're making it less and less likely that people who've got broad opinions on a broad range of subjects and who have said them publicly can get nominated for these things. So that said, I don't know if there's a chilling effect so much as there's a sort of sorting effect where if you're the kind of person who wants in life to get onto the Supreme Court, and obviously there's pretty long odds for anybody, you should pretty much keep your mouth shut about any issue of public or constitutional importance. Someone like Judge Bork, who had a long career of distinguished scholarship in constitutional law, would be very hard to get past this kind of controversial world nowadays, I think.
Though if you never say anything and never issue rulings, it's going to be hard. You're going to not pass the qualification test at some point, I guess.
Well, that's the other risk. Although if you're a sitting judge, or you're a practicing lawyer, Judge Roberts was first a practicing lawyer for many years and then a sitting judge, you've actually got the best defense because you can say, well, that was my client, so I made that argument on behalf of my client. You can't attribute that argument to me.
Let's expand another part of Dave's question. What was inherent in that is that this is a kind of a political tussle. How sincere are the senators in really trying to quiz the candidate, the nominee, and get at his or her ideology and how they feel about the Constitution? And how much is this just a chance to make political points?
I think it's a mix. I mean, for one thing, to really know sincerity, you have to be inside the minds of the senators, and I don't claim to be that. But I think both things are at work. I think partly this is political theater. It's on television. Some people are watching, although, as the caller suggested, it's not always the most thrilling television you could imagine. And so they're looking for some opportunity to make political points. But it's also true that there is, I think, on both sides of the aisle, a desire to see people going onto the court who have a judicial temperament, who've got good judgment, and, of course, who are experts in constitutional materials. And for that, questions about certainly their opinions and questions about issues of constitutional law seem to me to be completely fair game. And questions about the organizations one's belonged to or the views that one has held are fair game insofar as they may reveal something about personality or temperament.
And apart from ideology and politics, I guess there's a chance to learn a little bit about the minutiae and arcane points of law. Phrases come up like unitary executive. What does that mean?
The phrase unitary executive literally just means that in the Constitution, the entire executive power is given to the president. And that means, according to those advocates of this view, that Congress or the courts can't horn in on the president when he's exercising the powers that the Constitution gives to him. Now, on one level, that's completely unproblematic. Everyone who studies the Constitution would agree that the Constitution says that the executive power goes to the president, and that means it doesn't go to Congress and it doesn't go to the courts. But often, the phrase unitary executive has been used to mean that Congress can't do anything to limit the president when he's exercising his powers. So, for example, there's no question under the Constitution that the president is commander-in-chief. But what may Congress do to guide him in how he exercises his power in that way? Some advocates of the unitary executive theory would say that, for example, if the president needs to torture people as part of his constitutional duty to win a war, that Congress can't stop him from doing so. So that even if a law were passed by Congress, as in fact it hasn't passed, saying you can't torture people, the president could still torture those people regarding ignoring what Congress said because the Constitution entitles him to fight our wars as commander-in-chief. Same, some people might say, with respect to surveillance. The Constitution says the president can engage in our foreign policy. Well, maybe foreign policy involves eavesdropping on foreign agents. And so even if Congress says the president can't do that, then in theory he's still able to eavesdrop.
All right. Well, I thank you very much. Noah Feldman, professor at New York University Law School. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Coming up next, Peter Bergen joins us. He's bringing along his new book, The Osama Bin Laden I Know. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.